Well, thank you for being here today. So many people so interested in biology. It's encouraging. So I want to talk today about Adam and Eve and really three challenges about from the fossils, DNA, junk DNA, and then population genetics. Sounds really exciting, doesn't it, here? So I'd like to give a couple of disclaimers at the beginning here. Last week, Wendell gave the biblical and theological implications of Adam and Eve, and I'd just like to affirm that I'm with Wendell. So, actually, I really enjoyed his talk last week and took lots of notes and just really enjoyed it then. Just for those of us who are familiar with these different circles, essentials. This is not a center circle issue in Christianity. People do disagree on the topic about Adam and Eve and their historicity, so I'm just here to tell you what other people think today, really. I'm just the messenger. Don't shoot me. Really? Or when you talk about origins covers a lot of topics. It's usually portrayed as one or two things, but it really is much more sophisticated than that, and there are lots of topics. So one and your answer to each topic is really a separate answer, and the three questions don't have to interrelate. So the first one is the age of the Earth, the age of the universe, and we're not going to talk about that today. So that's off the table for today. Another topic is chemical evolution or the origin of the first cell, and that's off the table today. We're not talking about that either. Then within biological evolution, there are different topics. The first one is changes within a kind, changes within a species, and that's the one that pretty much everybody agrees on. We can see things changing over time within a species. The more controversial two are speciation from within a kind, and really this is Christians talk about this when Genesis says God made them to multiply after their kind. All kinds of questions. What did he mean by kind? Did God create original kinds from which there were subsetting within the original genetic diversity, or can species go from one kind to another? So it's really just that last one that we're talking about today, particularly when it comes to Adam and Eve then. So how were Adam and Eve made? Well, I thought I'd give you the punchline at the beginning, and then we could just take off and go eat lunch and enjoy fellowship today. So here are my conclusions. I wasn't there. I don't know. But that's okay, because nobody else knows either. We weren't there. Well, okay, God knows, but but the rest of us weren't. So really, it's reading between the lines. Everybody looks at the same data. It's really how you interpret the data that's where the conflict is. So I thought I'd start by looking at both a theologian and a philosopher and their topic on their view on origins here of Adam and Eve. So here it is, Calvin and Hobbes. Why is this snowman looking at a snowball? He's contemplating snowman evolution. Obviously, if he evolved from a snowball, it raises tough theological questions for him, like the morality of throwing one's precursors at someone. Sure, what about shoveling one's genetic material off the walk? So we're kind of doing that today then. So here are the three challenges then. The first challenge is the fossil record. Fossils, some claim, clearly show descent of Adam and Eve from pre-humans. So what are we going to deal with that then? Secondly, the genetic similarity among living things show that Adam and Eve could have were descended, depending on one's worldview, from other pre-humans then. And then thirdly, population genetics, term you've probably never heard before, but now you're talking about not particular crosses, but what happens in a population, the gene frequencies of a population. And the claim really is that the genetic diversity we have in humans could not have come from only two people. there had to be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people to start a population, to start a new species then. So what are we going to, you know, how do we deal with each of these three challenges then? Well, let me start with not how Adam and Eve were made, but who made Adam and Eve. And the data there for us as Christians is clear. Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And then chapter 2. Then the Lord God formed the man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. And the Lord God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. So for us, there's really no question about who made Adam and Eve. God made Adam and Eve. The question really is how Adam and Eve came about and what people think about that then. So again, none of us were there, so there are lots of different theories to deal with the data. Some of these is Wendell's going to talk about next time or, yeah, next time, whatever. Some do conflict with Christianity, and others don't conflict with Christianity. I'd like to introduce you to some authors today. The first one is Alvin Plantinga, who taught at Calvin and then went to Notre Dame to start a PhD program in philosophy, and he retired from there. And he wrote a book called Where the Conflict Really Lies. And he has concluded in this book, and here's the thesis of his book, that there is superficial conflict but deep concord between science and theistic religion, but superficial concord and deep conflict between sciences and naturalism. So the problem is not science and Christianity or theology. That's not the problem. That's the way it's portrayed by everybody, you know, but there really isn't. He says the conflict really is among the naturalists and what their worldview says, and there's deep disharmony between what the naturalists say and science. So it's the exact opposite of the case of what we hear when we hear this talked about. And really the conflict is, as I've been saying here, among worldviews then. I'd like to introduce you to another author. This is James Sire, editor, former editor for InterVarsity Press, and he wrote a book called The Universe Next Door. We have copies in our library if you want to read them. And he looks at different worldviews and compares them on the philosophy, questions of philosophy then. Like, what is the meaning, what is ultimate reality then? This is standard material, at least in, you know, when I taught in Christian colleges, that you talk, the freshmen come in, you talk about worldviews and conflicting worldviews and how people think differently, people with different worldviews then. So here's his definition of what a worldview is. It's a commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or a set of propositions held consciously, unconsciously, consistent or inconsistently about the basic construction of reality. Provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. So it's the orientation of our heart toward what's real then. And so in the book, he says then, compares actually lots of worldviews. Worldviews end in ism. So theism then, Christian theism. What is ultimately real? Well, God is ultimately real. And everything flows out of the character and person of God. Sire's words, prime reality is the infinite personal God revealed in the Holy Scriptures. This God is triune, transcendent and immanent, omniscient, sovereign and good. And we could add our own to that if we wanted to expand or contract that list, but ultimate reality is based in God. By contrast, naturalism, ultimate reality is stuff, matter and space and time then. Prime reality is matter. Matter exists eternally, and is all there is. God does not exist. So what you have when you come to the data are different people looking at the same data coming to different conclusions because of their worldview then. I mean, that's the basic line. Everybody's looking at fossils. Nobody disagrees that we have fossils on this earth. You know? Now, how do you interpret those fossils? How do you interpret them with regard to humans then? And a book that I read a long time ago, long out of print, by L. Dwayne Thurman, I think he taught at Oral Roberts University, How to Think About Evolution and Other Science Bible Controversies then. He says exactly what I've been saying. I got the idea from him. Here are the data. We all agree on the data. They're the data. But your worldview is going to determine how you interpret that data. So one person may interpret it like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, left to right, top to bottom. Another person's going to interpret it this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, top to bottom, and then left to right. So again, people are going to look at the same data and come to different conclusions about it. So here you go. Here are two T-Rexes, a guy in the front standing like a T-Rex is usually portrayed to stand, and the other guy is standing down here, you know, like this. And here's the caption to this. Man, talk about old school. Apparently Murray doesn't keep up with the latest paleontological theories regarding, what's it say, proper posture. There. It's not the we weren't there. We don't know. How does this guy stand? We don't know how he stand. So people are interpreting it differently. So there you go. Worldviews. So I want to introduce you to, you probably know Richard Dawkins. He's one of the four new atheists. He's probably convinced more people in our generation for atheism than anybody else. He's probably the most widely read atheist and listened to and atheist, you know, on the planet these days. Then he's written lots and lots of books. So what does he say about how Adam and Eve were created? Please tell me something I can tell Daddy, which he doesn't already know. The heartfelt plea of this child from Northern Ireland is the more poignant because his father happened to be a devout Christian, as is common in that unfortunate province. What nonsense might the boy have been fed from the cradle on? And what true knowledge could we offer in response? Perhaps this little boy, when he asked the perennial question, where did I come from, was told, God made you. Or, you came out of your mother, and she came from her mother, and so on, back to your great-great-great-great-grandmother, who came from Eve. And Eve, along with her husband Adam, was made by God. No educated person believes the Adam and Eve myth nowadays. But it's surprising how many parents think that it is somehow fun to pass on this falsehood and others in the same vein to their children. So clearly, there's the naturalistic explanation. There was no Adam and Eve. You know, we evolved. That's it. The fossils say we evolved. Everything else is actually deceit. You know, his most current recent book is The God Delusion. So if you think that there is a God, you are deluded. Here's Francis Collins, MD, PhD, Christian, former director of the Human Genome Project. The Human Genome Project was a project put together by the government, organized by the government, to tell the sequence of genes in the entire human genotype then, where our DNA is four letters, A, T, G, and C. So the Human Genome Project was to put together the whole sequence of ATGCs for every one of our cells, for all of our DNA in humans then. And then after that project was completed, he started the BioLogos Foundation. And I'll show you a little bit about BioLogos, and I'll be coming back and talking about them more today and next time. And he's currently director of the National Institute of Health, then the U.S. NIH. Then, so he's a really bright guy, and the bestseller book that he wrote is The Language of God. Subtitle here, Scientist Presents evidence for belief. So why, as a Christian, what I learned about DNA shows that there's a God, then? Francis Collins. Well, what does Collins say about Adam and Eve? What about Adam and Eve? Is the description of Adam's creation from the dust of the earth and the subsequent creation of Eve from one of Adam's ribs so powerfully described in Genesis 2 a symbolic allegory of the presence of the human soul into a previously soulless animal kingdom, or is this intended as literal history? The biblical texts themselves seem to suggest that there were other humans present at the same time that Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden. Otherwise, where did Cain's wife, mentioned only after he left Eden to live in the land of Nod, come from? So here's the homepage of the website of Collins's. Well, he's no longer the president. He started it, and he was now NIH director. But he started BioLogos then, with money from the Templeton Foundation. And so you can't read that, way too small. So I'm going to have to turn around here. So what we believe, okay, we believe the Bible is the inspired and authoritative Word of God. By the Holy Spirit, it is the living and active means through which God speaks to the church today, bearing witness to God's Son, Jesus, as the divine Logos, or Word of God. We believe that God also reveals himself in and through the natural world he created, which displays his glory, eternal power, and divine nature. Properly interpreted, Scripture and nature are complementary and faithful witnesses to their common author. We believe that all people have sinned against God and are in need of salvation. We believe in the historical incarnation of Jesus Christ as fully God and fully man. We believe in the historic death and resurrection of Jesus Christ by which we are saved and reconciled to God. So I'd look at that and say, oh, that's orthodox. You know, that's okay, and other statements along that line. And then I'd like to pop down to these last two. We believe that the diversity and intercorrelation of all life on earth are best explained by the God-ordained process of evolution with common descent. Thus, evolution is not in opposition to God, but a means by which God providentially achieves his purposes. Therefore, we reject ideologies that claim that evolution is a purposeless process or that evolution replaces God. We believe that God created humans in biological continuity with all life on earth. And I can't read the last line up there and too far away back, but so, Christian, Orthodox, claiming that the physical body was evolved then, and somehow God gave his soul to man and breathed on Adam, and Adam became a living being then in God's image then. So how do we think about these issues then? How do we go about looking at the data and just first of all, learning what people are saying? And I'd like to introduce you to Greg Kokel and a book that he wrote, Tactics, Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. If you haven't read this book, I'd really, really, really encourage you to read it. It's just a wonderful book on how, in a non-threatening way, we can talk about these important issues to unbelievers. And the answer is you don't talk, you listen, and you ask questions. So the first question you ask is, well, what do you mean by that? Just collecting information from people. And then you can move on to the next question. Well, how did you come to that conclusion? Asking them their supporting arguments for it. So it's a very, very good book. It was very freeing for me to think about how I can share with others about Christ. Well, here's a quote talking about Dawkins and how to think about these things from Tactics. And I really like this, and this one stuck in my mind when I read it, Tactics, a couple years ago. Oxford biologist Richard Dawkins, back to Dawkins, wrote a landmark work entitled The Blind Watchmaker. Notice the way he explains how flight might have evolved. This is Dawkins now. How did wings get their start? Many animals leap from bough to bough and sometimes fall to the ground. Especially in a small animal, the whole body surface catches the air and assists the leap or breaks the fall by acting as a crude airfoil. Any tendency to increase the ratio of surface area to weight would help, for example, flaps of skin growing out in the angles of joints. From here, there's a continuous series of gradations to gliding wings and hence to flapping wings. So how did birds and other animals learn to fly? Well, in a treetop, and some have a little bit bigger appendage or a little bit, you know, extra skin, and that slows them down, and then that increases, and they survive. You know, they don't go out like Wile E. Coyote, right? Ah! You know, they have these extra appendages. They go, kum. That was a lighter kum. So they survive, and then it's simple, isn't it? From there, wings develop. I mean, what could be so obvious? In the case of flight, this is back to Kokel. In the case of flight, Darwin's breezy account obscures two obstacles. First is the need for a massive infusion of new genetic information at just the right time and in just the right balance to accomplish the prodigious structural changes needed for flight. Second is the mechanical sensory, the ability to perceive where you are in three-dimensional, you know, space-time, psychomotor alterations required for the kind of flight that evolution could take advantage of. In order to overcome these serious hurdles, Dawkins needs to show the detailed and precise evolutionary pathway in specific cases of flight. This he does not do. And that's really common in biology. They just say, well, this could have happened from here in evolutionary biology. This could have gone from here to here to here. Ta-da! That's the way it happened. That's, okay, well, Kokel. Explanations like Dawkins are common in Darwinian circles. They're known derisively as just-so stories. After Kipling's book of the title, the children's book with chapters like How the Leopard Got His Spots, How the Camel Got His Hump. But stories like these pop up outside Darwinism, too. Make sure you're not lulled to sleep by them. There are three questions you should ask whenever someone offers an alternate explanation. Is it possible? Is it plausible? Is it probable? So just claiming that it happened this way isn't the same as demonstrating that it did happen that way. Just claiming that Adam and Eve came from hominids is different from demonstrating that they came from hominids then. Okay, so here are three challenges. Here's the first one. That was all background, and here's the first one. Fossils show common ancestry of humans with the great apes. Okay, so let's look at the data. How do we interpret the data? Do the fossils really show that? Okay. A little bit more background. For most of the history of the world, fossils and living things were considered as fixed, unchanging, that these species are the same species as had been around since the beginning of the world, since the beginning of creation. Linnaeus was the guy who founded our taxonomic system and gave names to every species. So if you, at some point in your career, had to learn kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, or you learned that you name species by their genus and species name, Homo sapien is human, you know, Liriodendron, Tulipifera is our state tree, Tula poplar, yellow poplar then. He's the guy. He's the guy who organized the naming system then. And when he looked at every species then, he wrote the following. Linnaeus wrote that he sought order in the diversity of living things ad majorem dea gloriam, for the greater glory of God. He wrote, Deus creavit, Linnaeus disfusit. God created, Linnaeus arranges. So the species were, for most of history, fixed. They didn't change. They've always been around. They've always been around pretty much like they are now. And then, I think, was written in a sketchbook. And you can see this sort of 1, A, B, C, D, and this sort of branching thing like this. And this is a page from a notebook from Charles Darwin in 1837, his first notebook on the transmutation of species then. So no longer are species thought to be fixed entities from the creation, but Darwin, and probably others around his time too, thought that they changed through time. And not only that, that they were connected in the past down here to the root of the evolutionary tree. And this paradigm dominates biology now. It's everywhere. You can't be a biologist without talking this talk in biology. So here's a current evolutionary tree. Three, remember that kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species? Well, now we have to add domain above kingdom. So it's domain, kingdom, phylum. Three domains, the bacteria, the archaea, old things, and the eukaryotes. And you notice over here, plants, fungi, and animals are just a small branch of the entire tree of life then. And this goes back to, here you go, common ancestry here. And this is mapped based on DNA maps of different organisms then, looking at the similarities and differences. So the greater the similarities in the DNA between two groups of organisms, the closer they are together. And the greater, you know, they would say here that these guys diverged from this trunk before these guys, and then these guys broke off, and these guys broke off, and eventually you get these guys breaking off here later in time, much more recently. So here's a current view held by biology of the tree of life and how everything on the planet is interrelated now, then. Okay, so a little smaller than I thought it'd be, but here's an orangutan. Here's an orangutan skeleton. I didn't notice till I put it up there. Somebody's got him sitting like that. Here's a gorilla. There's a gorilla skeleton then. Here's a bonobo. Couldn't find a picture of bonobo skeleton then. Here's a chimp. Bonobos are also called pygmy chimpanzees. Chimps have lighter faces. These guys have dark faces. So they're thought to be very closely related then. And then here's a human skeleton then. So, and this is, these are among the apes. These are the great apes. Apes and monkeys are different, right? Monkeys have tails, apes don't have tails. These are the great apes then. And so you look at the skeleton and you say, well, okay, what's my worldview? Did this come from these guys? Did these guys all come from common ancestry? Or were they separate species then? Well, you know, if you're a Christian, you can have a lot more possibilities on the origins than if there's a non-Christian. If you're a non-Christian and if there is no God, if you're an atheist and there is no God, your only explanation is common descent then. If you're a Christian, well, okay, maybe common descent, maybe not common descent. Let's look at the evidence and talk about it. So here is, again, the skeletons of these guys. And then here is the interpretation. Yes, we came from common ancestry. We have the orangs branching off, what is this? I can't see. I think it's 20 million years ago, so 15, 20 million years ago. And then the gorillas branched off. And then at this point, the bonobos and the chimps branched off, and we come to the line that leads to human. And that happened between 6 and 7 million years ago. So humans split off from the line that is turning into bonobos and chimps 6 to 7 million years ago. Now, just kind of as a little clarification here, nobody would say that humans came from chimp, right? People would say that human and chimp came from common ancestor, and the common ancestor is neither human nor chimp, right? That common ancestor then diverged and different populations turned over here into humans and over here turned into bonobos and chimps. Right. Everybody got that? It's not this way, it's this way, splitting back here. This is neither chimp nor human, but common ancestor to human and to chimp then. Okay, so zooming in now on the human line. This is the overall picture. Now we're just going to look at this line then. So this is hominid apes. This is hominin, the human line then. So we have fossils. Here's Lucy. How many of you have heard the title of the fossil Lucy? Well, that's the whole fossil right there. That's it. That's it. There are no others of this Australopithecine then. That's it. And as you'll show later, the fossils were found very quickly after a rainstorm across the whole hillside. So they don't even know if all these bones are of the same individual or if it's even the same species. But that's it. That's the complete data. They're the data for Lucy. That's the fossil of Lucy then. Okay, here is Homo erectus then. Homo is the genus for humans, right? Upright, as opposed to being down like this, like the apes. Upright man now. And here's the fossil. Sorry that they're a little darker than I thought. Here's a Neanderthal skeleton. And again, human skeleton. Oh, thank you very much. That helps a lot. There's a human skeleton. Okay, well, yeah. Yeah, kind of looks like that. Yeah, okay. Kind of looks like that. So now, what's my interpretation? What's my worldview going to say? Were these separate? Or were they, you know, direct descendant? Or are these on the line of us? Or were they not on the line for us then? Here's a standard picture of common ancestry here, 0 to 7 million years ago. So we have these other guys, we have these guys out here, Sahel, Aurorin, Ardipithecus. And here we have the Australopithecines, Australopithecine afarensis, that's Lucy, skeleton, others. Here's Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, humans. And here's the age range. So human fossils only go back, here's 1 million years. Human fossils only go back to there. So everybody agrees the human fossils are recent then. You know, you don't say human fossils are millions and millions of years old. You know, there's 1 million there. Here's human fossils right there. Here's Neanderthal back here from here to here. Here's Homo erectus fossil appearing here just before 2 million years ago, and going up to here. Here's Homo habilis, around 2 million years ago. Here's Lucy, between 4 and 3 million years ago. So the fossils are there. Here are the ranges and times of when they lived. Now, do we connect them? Do we connect the dots, or do we not connect the dots then? So if you connect the dots, then here's what you do. You say that the hominids, that humans, came from Neanderthal then. And actually, you can go out on their websites where you can send them a sample of saliva, and they will tell you how much Neanderthal DNA you have in your genome. Then, I think it's like 2 to 3 to 4% maybe. So people think that Neanderthals and humans crossbred then. Okay, so we draw these dots, dot, 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 back to Neanderthal. What do we do with Neanderthal? Well, Homo erectus is a different line, they say. So dot, 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 we connect Neanderthal, though, back to Homo habilis. And big dot, 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 we connect Homo habilis back to Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy. So again, do you connect the dots? Or do you not connect? Do you connect the dots, or do you not connect the dots? Then, again, nobody was there. Nobody knows. It's going to depend. You know, the difference is interpretation. How do you interpret the data? Then, here's the BioLogos Foundation, and Francis Collin connects the dots. In recent decades, scientists have discovered more about the beginnings of humanity. The fossil record shows a gradual transition over 5 million years ago from chimpanzee-sized creatures to hominids with larger brains who walked on two legs. Later, hominids used fire and stone tools and had brains as large as modern humans then. Fossils of Homo sapiens date back nearly 200,000 years. So this book by Gauger, Axe, and Luskin was put out by the Discovery Institute. The Discovery Institute is an organization that promotes intelligent design. So whenever you see these Discovery Institute, they're intelligent design. God is working behind the scene. They don't even name the God, but they're... Let me back up. There is an intelligence behind the scene of some type. Maybe it's God, maybe it's not God, but they're just arguing there's some type of intelligence behind life on Earth and human life and evolution to guide it, to direct it. It shows too much evidence that there must be some kind of designer behind that. They don't put a name behind the designer, but it's a designer. So this book was really helpful to me then. So here's some things she wrote. Here's Lucy then. And as I said, there's not a lot of data. That's it. You know, only 40% of the skeletons found, little of the skull. Very hard to do brain size to fit it into a continuum if you don't have the skull. Half a pelvis, half a femur. Here's the femur. Here's the pelvis then. That's it. Bones were scattered across the hillside, not known for sure if they're the same individual or even the same species then. Unknown whether they knuckle walked or if they were upright. You know, you're going to be able to tell that by the shape of the pelvis, if it supports being upright structure or down. The inner ear bones then, which are involved in balance. You need different balance if you're up like this as opposed to if you're walking like this. So we can look at the skull and tell those things. Some think that high shoulders, a funnel-shaped chest, no waist, and a pot belly would have prohibited running. So most think that, some say she knuckle-walked, most deny it then. Okay, so kind of let's take a little sidetrack and say, well, how do we differ from other species then? You know, what changes would have to be made? Well, we walk upright. We have longer legs and shorter arms. We'd have different muscles to hold us upright as opposed to being down like this. Much larger brain. Different muscles in our hands and tongue and face for communication. We do much more communication than other apes do. Hairlessness. Changes in the position of our eyes, ability to think abstractly, that are characteristic of humans, that are not characteristic of the other apes. Art, language, music are characteristic of humans, not other species then. We'd need a new spine for this evolution to take place. We'd have different pelvis. We'd have legs in different position then. Upright posture, as I've been talking about, the positioning of the skull from being forward like this, the position, the way the skull sits on the spine, jaws and muscles for talking and communication then, flattened face as opposed to this angular face in the apes then. And so, again, it's one thing to say it could have happened. It's something very different to say that it did happen this way. So what Ann Gauger did is look at two proteins that were thought to have come about by a common ancestry in E. coli, in a bacteria then, and to say, okay, to change this one protein, just one gene change, to change one gene into another, estimated would take 10 to the 27 years. Put a 1 and put 27 zeros in back of it then. That's how many years it would take to change one protein into another. The universe, according to standard cosmology, is only 10 to the 10th years. This is to change one gene into another gene then. So now think about all those changes that have to happen in humans to change one species into another then. How many changes would it take to move from Lucy to Homo erectus then? Bunch of different features. One mutation, because humans multiply so much slower than bacteria do. Our generation time is, what, 25 years? Bacteria can double every 20 minutes then. So the mutation rate is going to be much slower. Estimate, one mutation, 6 million years. These fossils aren't near that long, old. Two mutations, 216 million years. That's for two out of the 16. How do you get all those others happening? You know, you're just multiplying the improbability that this would happen then. The time between this fossil and this fossil is 1.5 million years. There's just not enough time if you think through the details. Again, it's something to tell a breezy story. It's something else to look at the details of how one species could have changed into another then. Conclusion, given these numbers, it's extremely improbable, if not absolutely impossible, for us to have evolved from hominid ancestors by a gradual, unguided process. There's just not enough time. If you're looking at the genetic changes that have to take place. This guy's no friend of Christianity, Ernst Mayr, one of the top minds, was one of the top minds in biology then, atheist. He wrote, "The earliest fossils of Homo, the genus of which humans are in, Homo rudolfensis and Homo erectus are separated from Australopithecus by a large unbridged gap." How can we explain this seeming saltation, this jump from one species to a very, very different species? How do you talk about that? Not having any fossils that can serve as missing links, we have to fall back on the time-honored method of historical science, the construction of a historical narrative. In other words, a just-so story. Then. I'm going to stop for today there. So, thank you, and I'll give you the shorter challenges for 2 and 3 next week. So, thank you very much.